I'm Artie Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. A new Esquire NBC News survey found that Americans are angrier than they were a year ago. Digging deeper, whites are angrier than blacks and Hispanics. Republicans are angrier than Democrats. Middle-income people are angrier than the poor and the rich. And women are angrier than men. That's a lot of anger. We're going to take apart this study and talk about what is ticking people off and why. And joining us is Richard Dormant. He's senior editor at Esquire. The poll in Esquire is titled American Rage. And Richard Dormant, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And with us here in our Philadelphia studio is David Love. He's a journalist and commentator. He writes for The Griot, for Atlanta Black Star, and for Huffington Post, among others. And David Love, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Well, thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. So how angry are you, Richard Dormant?
Well, like a lot of Americans, I look out and I see a lot of angry people around me. You know, it's really become the national characteristic of the dialogue as we see it right now. And unlike previous moments in our culture, it's not sort of isolated to discrete pockets on the political or the ideological spectrum. We're seeing it everywhere. We're seeing it in our political campaigns. We're seeing it in our protest movements. And we're seeing it in a national dialogue on race, gender, and national identity in a way that we haven't seen in a generation.
How about for you, David? Or how silly way to start the show. How angry are you? We were talking before the air and before going on. I have to say, you know, I'm pretty angry myself.
I think a lot of people are angry. And, you know, when you look at it, there are so many changes going on in society, a lot of transformation. Economically, you see rising inequality. You know, looking at the situation with criminal justice, you have police shootings on an ongoing basis. People are angry about mass incarceration, and there is at times a sense of hopelessness that there isn't much that people can do. So a lot of frustration. And unfortunately, during these times, people will find scapegoats. If they are powerless and feel as if they don't have control over their lives, they're always looking for someone to blame for those problems.
And that's really the danger of having an angry country, yes?
Yes. Anger, when channeled in negative ways, I think we're seeing that with Donald Trump, unfortunately. He has been able to grab onto something. He knows that people, particularly whites, disaffected whites, they are angry and they have every reason to be due to their loss of income and what have you. But his ploy is to blame the Muslims or to blame Mexican immigrants, to blame to some degree African Americans, people who are the, I would say, most disenfranchised, most vulnerable, as opposed to blaming those who actually might be more culpable in terms of the problems that they face economically.
Richard, let me go back to you. And as I said, I wanted to sort of take apart this survey. And according to this survey, you know, whites are angrier than African Americans, than Hispanics. What is that anger about?
Well, what we see here is what we're calling the anger of perceived diminishment. When we polled all our respondents on not only questions of anger, but their thoughts on things like the state of the American dream and their sense of American leadership in the world, whites in particular have high correlation between the rates of anger and the frequency of anger and their sense that not only is the American dream dead, but that America is no longer the most powerful country in the world and that their lives didn't turn out as well as they thought it would when they were younger. So they feel like they've been sold this bill of goods, and they're looking around and they sense this disenfranchisement and then a sense of sort of a broken promise. And that, in a large part, is what's fueling their anger.
Is it also they look around and they see a country that is becoming less and less white, so somehow they feel left behind or left out?
I think in this specific regard, I think it's more sort of sociocultural than it is ethnic. And when we sort of turn the attention to issues like immigration, Whites are obviously much more, as you would imagine, much more hostile to immigrants and to immigration than to members of the Black and Hispanic communities. That also correlates to a sense of that the American dream is no longer working out, and that America is no longer as powerful as it used to be. So there is this sense of a changing America that isn't quite what they thought it would be when they were younger.
Let me pick up on one thing, then we'll get David Love back in on the conversation. One of the things, Richard, in your survey is that African Americans seem to believe more in the American dream than white Americans. Do I have that right?
That's right. And they're actually generally less angry, despite a year in which the news have been dominated by police violence and mass incarceration. Black Americans are generally less angry than whites, and they are more optimistic about the state of the country. Mm. The sole exception to that, quite understandably, is when you ask Black Americans about police violence against blacks. They're you know, much more likely to report being angry than whites or Hispanics are. Other than that, though, on a host of other issues, they don't get nearly as angry as whites.
Well, and you do not speak for all Black Americans, David Love, but I'd be curious about your response to that. Help us understand that.
Yes, I would say that blacks, Latinos, other people of color have every right to be the angriest, given the long history for centuries of oppression, discrimination, deprivation. And yet, my insight into this study, and I think it's interesting, I believe that because African Americans and other minority groups do not have the high expectations in society, they have less to be angry about because they really didn't expect to get much in the first place.
So they're not disappointed.
Exactly. But on the other hand, with white Americans who unconsciously or subconsciously have not been aware of white privilege, suddenly they're in a situation where they feel as if that's being taken away. And if you have something taken away or think you have something taken away from you that you've enjoyed for your whole life, it seems like an injustice. Mm. So there's this notion that African Americans, Latinos, others are somehow benefiting but at the expense of white Americans. And that sentiment can turn to violence. We've seen that in the past with the rise of the Ku Klux Klan after the Civil War. I think we're seeing it now with the ascendancy of white militia groups. And that's something that we should be concerned about.
Does it also mitigate for, let's say, African Americans or even minorities that at least for the last 7 years we've had a black president? I mean, does that somehow say perhaps America is a place where we can succeed?
I think that is the case. The president has been a substantial source of pride for African Americans, and I think that to the extent he has lobbied on their behalf, advocated for issues of importance to them, I think most recently with criminal justice reform as well as dealing with gun violence, other issues, I think that that's a big source of pride. At the same time, people also see the backlash, the movement against the president. You know, all, you know, sincere disagreements over policy notwithstanding, there has been a movement that has grown out of fear of a black president. There is talk about opposition to his policies, but I think it's more an issue of we are against Obamacare. We are against everything that he does because he is who he is.
Do you want to weigh in on that at all, Richard, from the survey?
Right. Well, one thing that we polled specifically was all respondents' view of race relations as they've changed or not changed since Barack Obama became president. And one interesting thing we saw was that Black Americans are much more likely to say that race relations have improved or stayed the same over the past 8 years than whites. Whites are actually much more down on race relations. And you can get into any sort of, there are lots of theories as to why that might be. But one of the theories is that As David pointed out, there's a sense of a heightened awareness of white privilege, or a sense of the relationship between various ethnicities in America. Another theory might be that white Americans don't particularly like the way that they are being treated by the media. There are lots of different theories here. But again, it's interesting that despite near constant and tragic news about police violence and about heightened awareness of mass incarceration, it is Black Americans who are feeling bullish on the progress of race relations.
Richard, let me pick up on something, and this was actually an interview we did a couple of months ago, a study of finding looking at a certain subset of white Americans, middle age, struggling through the recession, their rates of suicide, their rates of drug and alcohol abuse. Really just through the roof and perhaps reflecting this sense of pessimism about their own future, about how they fit into this changing country, and not believing that there is a place for them.
I read that study as well. It's fascinating, and there are all sorts of possible explanations for these the sort of mass mortality and the high suicide rates. Among them, and the one that I find most convincing is heroin and opioid abuse, in part caused by chronic pain. The source of that is a little bit confusing and unclear. But I think that there are any ways that you can explain sort of the sort of lost generation, so to speak.
I'm thinking of, and I'll put this to you, David Love, which is, we had the Occupy movement. It still exists, although not, I think, the way it was a couple of years ago. The Tea Party movement, Black Lives Matter. I mean, these are all groups that are organizing, rallying against things that they see that are wrong with this country. Do you see that as a good sign?
I see that as a very good sign. I think that if we were to see complacency, I would be concerned. But these are very positive developments, for whatever flaws these movements may or may not have. I think that to the extent that they are trying to get to the bottom of the problems in society and trying to come up with constructive methods of change, it can only be a good thing. And I believe that the detractors of social justice movements may look at this, the critics, and say this is a bad thing, this is a destructive thing. They look at these movements as somehow as an insidious force because they don't want to deal with the underlying problems, I believe.
But it sounds like what you're saying, worse than this would be giving up, boredom, not paying attention.
Exactly. Giving up, I think, is a recipe for disaster. You want to be engaged with these issues, as painful and difficult as they are. One day, things will get better. But it's a long, protracted struggle and a lot of frustration along the way.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about what Americans are angry about. And that was the reason for a recent Esquire NBC News poll tapping into some of the things that are making people angry. Richard Dormant joining us by telephone. Senior
10 seconds remain. Please conclude your message.
Uh-oh. Don't leave us. Richard Dormant, a senior editor at Esquire. Also with us, David Love. He's a journalist and commentator here in Philadelphia, and lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about a recent Esquire NBC News poll that found that half of the country's population is angrier than they were a year ago. Many reasons to fuel some of this frustration and outrage. And we are discussing what's behind some of this outrage and anger and, frankly, what can be done about it. Richard Dormant is our guest and David Love as well. An explosion of phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. Richard, let me go back to this survey, and I'll just read this here. If you were going to attend a protest, what would your sign say? Black Lives Matter, 14%. Black Lives Matter is a hate group, 6%. Make English America's official language, 24%. We don't build walls, we tear them down, 17%. Keep your hands off my uterus, 12%. Abortion is murder, 13%. Don't tell me how to dress, tell them not to rape, 18%. We came unarmed this time, 6%. The NRA kills our kids, 10%. Telling us, you know, the sort of broad range of issues that get people either to a protest movement or to think about it or to claim one of these issues. I mean, in certain ways, you can say that's great. You know, people care about a diverse bunch of stuff. What does this finding tell us?
Well, I think what's interesting is that particularly among party affiliations, we're protesting different things, right? So for Democrats, we found that they tend to focus on pro-immigration, pro-women's rights, and surprisingly enough, anti-tax slogans. For Republicans, it's anti-tax, not surprisingly, anti-immigration, anti-abortion. So you have, again, this sort of sense of anger and a sense of frustration, but at the same time, they're finding different expressions and they're being directed in different ways.
And David, you were talking about some of these protest movements. I mean, it's an interesting list, and to see it's all over the place. I guess the biggest one here, at least according to the survey, make English America's official language, followed by don't tell me how to dress, tell them not to rape. Black Lives Matter, they're in it at about 14%. So clearly a player.
Yes, no question. And in such a short period of time, when you think about it, the Black Lives Matter movement has only been around for 2 years or so, and already it's making a, I would say, a big impact on the national scene.
I've seen variations on that. Police lives matter. Mm-hmm. You know, white people. I mean, it's a question, and you see candidates sort of trying to figure out how to answer that question about Black Lives Matter.
Mm-hmm.
It's become a litmus test in a lot of ways.
I think it has, yes. And it's something new in politics, I think. I think one could make the argument that for very long, politicians did not have to answer to the black community on certain issues. And this is a brand new issue, although, you know, on the political scene, it's a brand new issue. For the African American community, police brutality, violence has been around since day one. So I think it'll take some time. I think, you know, in the beginning of this election season, we saw how the various political candidates for president have had an evolution on the issue. And I think that they have improved, at least on the Democratic side. On the Republican side, there is a tendency, I think, to either ignore the issue completely or to say, oh, those are cop killers, which is not necessarily a very constructive way to look at the issue. But
well, Richard, let me go back to you. And what do you see in terms of gender differences? Are men and women angry about different things?
Well, what's interesting, I think, in particular, when you break down by gender, is that the issue of empathy comes into play. Women share a lot of the same frustrations as men as far as the direction of the country and the direction of their own lives. But what we also see is that women are much more likely to be angry about the mistreatment of others that they see and hear about in the news, whether it's police violence against the black community or discrimination against LGBT individuals or immigrants. They're much more likely to register high rates of anger when it relates to that. So in addition to those dashed expectations about the direction of the country, this heightened sense of empathy and compassion for the mistreatment of others really elevates their sense of anger.
So that women, I mean, sort of broadly speaking, are more angry than men?
Broadly speaking, yes. And the reason for that is this question of empathy, which I think perhaps as a surprise to nobody is not something that a lot of men excel in.
All right. I will let that just hang out there. We'll comment on that. But what about the fact, Richard, that we are in, you know, the middle of a really contentious presidential race? How much do you think our politics or even the way we talk about politics fuels people's anger?
Well, I think it cuts both ways. One is you take somebody like Donald Trump, whose now famous slogan, Make America Great Again, is really resonating among a certain pocket of voters across America who tend to be, older white Americans. And these are exactly the people that we found in our survey who no longer feel that the country is the most powerful in the world, or that the American dream is dead and that life didn't turn out as well as they thought it would. They're really angry about that. And so when Donald Trump comes out with a slogan like Make America Great Again, he's sort of identifying and exploiting that feeling. And it really resonates. It's really working based on, you know, pretty much every primary poll that we see. Whether or not that resonates in a larger campaign is, of course, an open question.
But it seems, David, I mean, Democrats are – it seems to me Democrats are probably as angry as Republicans. They might just be angry about different things.
Yes. And I think in the case of Democrats and progressives in particular, there's a tendency to look at things in terms of an economic issue, you know, the inequality and looking at Wall Street and the excesses of the 1%. So there's definitely a lot of anger, but an identification of different sources of that anger and concern.
Let me get some callers in. We got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. And we have Jesse from Jonestown, Pennsylvania. And Jesse, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I just have a question regarding white privilege. As a middle-class white person, I have seen my parents struggle their entire lives. I've seen myself struggle my entire life. And I'm just wondering when this white privilege will start kicking in and what exactly should I be expecting?
I like the way you put that, Jesse. That's really good. David, can I go back to you? And then, Richard, if you can weigh in as well.
Sure. There's no question that there are many whites in this country that do not feel privileged and who are poor and who feel that they're slipping behind. But you have to look at the country as a whole and the way it was built. And the fact of the matter is that on the social hierarchy, white Americans, however poor, were always seen as being at least one rung above blacks. So white privilege comes in many forms. It's not just an issue of how much money you have or what kind of job, how much wealth you have. It's the type of things that you don't even think of, such as if I walk down the street, what are the chances that I will run into a police officer and there will be an altercation and I wind up dead? That's something that white Americans may not necessarily have to worry about as much. I know that as an African American, as a black father, it's something that I think about and many in the community have to think about, particularly as we see these reports constantly of people being killed by cops.
You want to weigh in on that, Richard Dorman? I like the way Jesse framed it, which is, you know, when am I going to get my white privilege? But you did find some racial differences in this survey.
We did. And I think what it comes down to for a lot of people is a sense of security. You know, anger we found is sort of one side of a coin, and the other is fear. And those are two issues that are sort of really both stemming from the sense of insecurity that we feel around us. I think what David was speaking to was a very literal, physical, life and death sense of insecurity that a lot of black and Hispanics feel as they walk down the street. What Jesse is suggesting, while no less legitimate, is a sense of economic insecurity, that he doesn't feel as though there's a place for him in the 21st century economy. I think both of those feelings tend to result in, at least what we found in our survey, a high degree of anger and a high degree of insecurity.
And you see fear as a kind of flip side of anger, Richard?
I do. And I think that's something that we really see playing out in our in the presidential campaign right now, as far as whether the issue is immigration or, you know, what to do with Syrian refugees. I think a lot of the candidates, particularly Republican candidates, are casting these issues explicitly in the language of fear as a way of appealing to people's sense of insecurity.
Mm, and maybe sense of anger and outrage. David, do you want to add anything to that?
Mm. Yeah. I use the analogy of walking down the street and being, you know, the fear of being shot by police. But there
How about people crossing the street when they see you?
Oh, yes. I do experience that. Yeah. There are those subtle things, you know, that there's implicit bias in society. One of the new buzzwords. it is it's something that African Americans have to think about on a daily basis. And there's you know, the issue of when you apply for a job and being denied because you have a black sounding name or for being black, the fact that black unemployment is double the rate among whites, systemic issues that I feel the country hasn't really come to terms with, and now we're beginning to, and I think that is causing some of this this conflict.
Oh, so the fact that we are beginning to at least start to wrestle with some of these issues has perhaps created this sense of anger, frustration, fear, all the things we've been talking about?
Oh, I definitely think that's a factor, and the notion that black people are racist for bringing up the issue of racism.
Let me just quickly reintroduce everybody. That's David Love. He's a journalist, commentator, lives and works here in Philadelphia. He's written for a number of publications, The Griot, Huffington Post, Atlanta Black Star. Also with us and joining us by telephone, Richard Dormant. He's senior editor at Esquire, and we're talking about a new Esquire NBC news poll looking at what makes people so angry. And we're getting to the bottom of this during this hour. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And just a quick suggestion to our emailers. Don't write me an entire paragraph here. I cannot read all of that and also carry on a live conversation. So keep your comments as short as you possibly can, and we'll try to get them on the air. Let me get Tom from New Jersey to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Tom. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. This is Tom from the suburbs of New Jersey. I'm one of those 50-something white guys.
Sure.
I think it's changed in the rate of change and the pace of change. Just it blows my mind that 7 years ago, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton could be debating who was strongest on marriage being between a man and a woman. And then 7 years later, if I said I believe marriage is between a man and a woman, I would be mocked in some circles and called a bigot. And it's not necessarily that change isn't inevitable and isn't good. It's just, I think, the pace of change is troubling to some. The other issue I just want to bring up briefly, people would mock you for being anti-Muslim or something if you bring up terrorism or something like that. But then you stand next to the Rockefeller Christmas tree with your granddaughter, and there's people in a flak jacket with high-powered automatic weapons. That is the effect that many are feeling in the country regarding terrorism. Well, so I don't know.
I hear you. Let me take the first point, because I think we haven't really touched on it. And Richard, I'll go back to you, which is, and it's true, Tom says we live in a fast-paced world. Things are changing almost before our eyes on certain issues and certain phenomena. How much do you think that has fueled people's maybe fear/anger?
Well, I think David raised the point earlier that this is the first time that a lot of these people are having these conversations, whether it's about race or gender or national identity. And the fact that we're having them all simultaneously, more or less at the same time, for the first time in a generation, I think can feel sort of overwhelming to people. And what tends to happen when people either feel overwhelmed or, as I said before, insecure about how they feel or perceive the world, then that can lead to feelings of anger and a sense of confusion.
While we're talking, a big TV screen I have over my my right shoulder here, watching the news, and I wonder for you, David Love, how much you think just not just the news itself, but the way, especially on television, the way news is presented to people makes people angry, either at each other, at the news media, at the news itself.
I believe it plays a big role because, unfortunately, in the world of cable news and the 24-hour news cycle, many news outlets are owned by companies that care about entertaining the audience. So you have news organizations that are owned by companies that also sell movies and other forms of entertainment. And unfortunately, I believe that because there is this emphasis on advertising revenue, on making the big bucks, on ratings, there in many cases is a concerted effort to actually push buttons on people. I think
using
that,
conflict, you mean?
Exactly. Making everything like a drama to pull people in. And the flip side of that, of course, is that some people become enraged.
Yeah, indeed. Richard, how much do you think just, you know, our news media, such as it is, are responsible for how – or partially responsible for how angry people are?
Dave, I think David's right that at least broadcast media tends to thrive. Certainly not radio. Television broadcast certainly thrives on conflict. But what I think hasn't been discussed is the role of social media in all this. And one thing that we found in our survey is that social media users tend to be angrier than non-social media users. So what happens is when you open up your Twitter feed or you look at the comment section of a news story, the people who are posting that tend to be distorted views or amplified views of how the rest of the country is feeling. So it's entirely possible to be on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, all these social feeds, and get a sense that all around you there's nothing but rage. And maybe you're seeing in your everyday life, like, people don't seem that angry. You know, people seem perfectly, you know, maybe a little frustrated, but then you look on your social media feed and everyone is just outraged. So there is this sort of funhouse mirror-like effect to the way social media amplifies and distorts how we feel.
We're almost up on a break here, David, but I know that that's something you and I were talking about before going on the air.
Yes. Social media, I believe, is an effective way to empower people. And I think that, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement, other movements have benefited from it. But I think it does, and I do agree, that it also can reflect a sense of powerlessness and frustration. So you have a lot of anonymous people on social media who are venting, and there's definitely no way around that.
There it is,
something.
Right?
Yes.
Well, we are talking about what makes people angry, and apparently a lot of Americans are angry these days. That's one of the findings of a new Esquire NBC News poll. Richard Dormant joining us by telephone. He's senior editor at Esquire. And David Love with us here in our Philadelphia studio. He's a journalist and a commentator, and we've got a lot of comments. I'll try to read through some of them and also get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about people being angry. And jumping off a survey that was published in Esquire American Rage, the Esquire NBC News survey. Let me just read a couple of comments we have here. People are mad. Almost every citizen that works is struggling. One reason is the increased cost of health care under the Affordable Care Act. An email from Beverly: the polls on anger in America can be very misleading. I could answer that I don't think the America is going the right direction, but for completely different reasons than people who follow Trump. An email from Jeanette: I'm very left-leaning liberal Democrat. My best friend has political views on the opposite end of the spectrum. We have very differing ideas about the direction of the country, but we love each other, and it's never a problem. Happy to hear that. A comment from Jose: I'm angered by the fact that government can intrude on me personally and that I have no recourse for it. An email from Paul. He says, as an upper-middle-class white male from the suburbs, I don't feel white privilege, but every time a police officer drives through my neighborhood and we smile and wave at each other, I can't help but know it exists. And David, that's something you were referencing earlier. These interactions, I guess, these small interactions that can tell us something about privilege.
Yes, and privilege in many ways is invisible because people don't have a reference point. They don't realize that some groups of people are treated differently simply because of their race or color or religion or what have you. So it's a rude awakening, and I think in some cases they don't necessarily believe it. They have to experience it.
In order to believe it. Let me go back to this poll and go back to you, Richard, which is, and I found this really interesting, that middle class, broadly speaking, again, middle class people are angrier than rich people. That makes sense. But also feeling more angry than poor people feel. And that makes no sense to me.
Right. I mean, I think it has to get back to your sense of expectations, that perhaps people who are very poor don't have as high of expectations for their life. So therefore, they're not quite as disappointed. I think particularly when you look at the angriest group who make between $50,000 and $75,000 a year, maybe they had bigger plans for their lives that they're saying now didn't quite work out. And that sort of residue of hope and of optimism is what's, a large part of what's making them angry.
Richard, what do you suggest people do if they are angry? What do we do with all this anger?
Yeah, I think there are lots of different sort of positive. I would emphasize the sort of positive nature of it to affect social change, whether it's getting involved in organizations that are looking to affect change, positive change. That would somehow rectify or remedy whatever is making you angry. But at the same time, engaging in positive conversation with maybe people who don't have the same viewpoints as you do, so that, again, there's this sense of maybe bitterness going on in our national dialogue right now between people who maybe don't necessarily think alike. And I think that can be, further unhelpful and destructive. So I think, again, this idea of keeping things positive and channeling our anger in useful ways is the way to go.
What do you think, David?
I agree with all that. I believe that people should find organizations they can join, some sort of cause that is greater than themselves. Even things as simple as writing a letter to the editor or an op-ed to voice their concerns, I think it can be a very cathartic experience.
And would it be fair to say is that we live in sort of weirdly segregated political worlds or even media worlds, that we tend to get the media that makes us think that we're right about everything that we believe? David?
Exactly. I think that you find people segregated into camps, and increasingly there's no common ground, whether it's in the media or on Capitol Hill. And if we don't change that, then I don't think we're going to see any progress, really.
You want to weigh in on that, Richard?
I think he's absolutely right. I think, I think in certain respects, this will hopefully be a passing moment in our culture, as far as all of these groups and all of these people being angry, and that we'll find a way out of it. But I think that's something that we have to decide for ourselves. And hopefully, when the dust settles on the primary campaigns, we'll have a little bit less vitriol and a little bit sort of flame-throwing going on to incite some of our baser instincts.
Because there's something about primary campaigns that makes people angry or taps into their anger?
A lot of red meat, a lot of playing to the base, which I think can be not entirely positive for the country at large.
Let me read a couple of more emails. An email from Christopher: social media users are not angrier. Those users have used the media and outlets. A tweet from Lojo: there are groups that actively troll Twitter to harass and argue with even the littlest opinion. I mean, we have done whole shows about the Twitterverse, such as it is. Let me get Kate from Germantown to join our conversation. Hi, Kate. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there.
I'm calling
as a daughter, a millennial daughter to middle-aged white, middle-class parents, and just speaking to the fragility of the white middle class. And I think the American dream, which I think we're now more able to see, was always sort of a lie. You know, our country is built on capitalist exploitation all over the world. And the middle class was a tool that used that. And the middle class was only built when we demanded and stood up for our rights, to have the New Deal and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to understand that what exists is a long history of settler mentality that white people are particularly prey to. And we can find our humanity and our common dignity beyond that. And that's sort of where I have to go with my parents, because there's a lot of rage, but we have to see ourselves outside of our immediate reality and see ourselves within the history. And people who've been oppressed have had to see that. They haven't had the luxury of this invisibility that white people have had.
Well, Kate, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And David,
thank you.
You're welcome, Kate. Thanks for the call. David, I see you nodding your head.
Yeah, yeah. There are some clear policy decisions that are creating the rage, I believe, among whites, and they may not realize it. I believe that if people start to fight for the policies that will help put them in a better place, that will begin to make them feel better.
Such as?
Well, I think something as simple as a minimum wage, public works policies to have more jobs, things of that nature. Student debt. People are drowning due to the situation with college debt, making student debt – actually making college tuition free. Things of that nature would really help people on a day-to-day basis.
Well, and that's interesting, Richard, to frame it in terms of some policy solutions. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, I do. But at the same time, I think not everybody looks at policies the same way. So to give you an example about something like income inequality, in our survey, when we asked about income inequality, pretty much everybody across the board politically recognizes that it's the gap between the wealthy and everybody else is increasing, and nobody's happy about it. But when you ask people why that is, Democrats and Republicans have far different answers. Republicans are much more likely to blame globalization and outsourcing for the income inequality that we're seeing across America. Democrats, meanwhile, look at Wall Street and the financial industrial complex as the source of all these problems. So you have one common problem, income inequality, but you have two sets of people viewing two different sources. So I don't know what the policy answer would be to that that would somehow make everybody happy. It's so I think it's a little bit thornier than just sort of, you know, finding a solution.
David?
Well, politics is about compromise. And I think one could argue that both outsourcing and these other issues are the problem. But if you don't have people at the table who are willing to talk about the universe of solutions, then there's stagnation, which is what we have now.
Kate, thanks for the call. Let me see what Robert from New Jersey has to say. Robert, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Go ahead.
I'm calling. You mentioned reference point for white privilege earlier, and I thought that was really insightful because, I'm white. I used to not understand white privilege, and I lived in China for a while, and I realized that everyone has a bias towards people that remind them of themselves, which, you know, when you're talking about higher ups at work or anywhere when you're trying to make it for yourself, plays a huge impact that goes invisible to people that don't understand that they have that.
I mean, it is interesting to go to another country and perhaps I hear you saying, Robert, and sort of see yourself differently or through different people's eyes. David?
Yes, I think for those who have visited, lived, worked, and studied in foreign countries, there is that sense of being the other. You know, I don't believe in color blindness necessarily. You know, I think that we should acknowledge the differences among people. The only problem is when people use those differences against people. Mm-hmm. So when people are discriminated against because of what they look like or who they are, that is the issue, I believe. And that's implicit bias at work.
Richard, let me go back to you. We've been talking about some of the differences of what makes people angry. Did you find there were things that men and women, Republicans and Democrats, young and old, everyone agreed that this really made them angry?
Gun violence. Interesting. Which is, of course, strange given what we're seeing happening in the U.S. Congress as far as a fundamental disagreement on what to do about gun violence, whether it's additional gun control or additional mental health spending. But that's the one issue that we found across the board, across, you know, household income, geography, political affiliation, gender, race. It makes everybody just furious when they hear about gun violence.
Oh, that's so interesting. I mean, and I guess the question is, then what is done about that? I mean, taking the anger and turning it into something more effective than just anger. An email from Anonymous: why is it okay to be part of a pro-black organization? Isn't that racism too? Aren't we beyond that? Angry groups of white people are labeled as supremacists. An email from Matthew: I don't think it's that white people are privileged so much as it is that non-whites are disprivileged. An email from Renee Richard: I would change the word expectation to attitude of entitlement. Poor and people of color know that hard work does not always equal a way out. An email from WM: the state's budget impasse has made me angry. And that's here in Pennsylvania. We still don't have a budget, and the budget was supposed to be passed on July 1st. Let me get Christopher from Fox Chase to join our conversation. Hi, Christopher. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
You know, I was homeless, living on the street for 2 years, and more than half the people I ended up hanging out with were Native Americans. You always hear African Americans complaining about discrimination against African Americans. You always hear Muslims complaining about discrimination against Muslims. You always hear Latinos complaining about discrimination against Latinos. You never hear anybody complaining about discrimination against Native Americans, and they're at the very, very bottom of the totem pole, totally disenfranchised, totally disgraced, and yet I never saw anybody less angry.
That's interesting, Christopher, and obviously a long history there. Richard, do you want to respond to Christopher's comments about his experience as a homeless guy?
Right. Well, just as far as the Native American issue is concerned, I mean, that's something we'd very much wanted to sample Native Americans in our survey. But they are such a small part of the population that it was very hard to get a representative sample. So unfortunately, that they were not someone that we could poll as far as being representative of America. But I think you're right. I think there are lots of issues that a lot of people could be angry about today that they have a right to be angry about. Whether or not they're actually being angry about it is another issue altogether.
That's an interesting way to frame it. David, do you want to add to that?
As far as the Native American issue, I will agree. They are a rather invisible group. And I think if you need evidence of that, look at the current standoff in Oregon, where actually that land is there was a local Native American tribe. That's their land. And they have said that they want those militias to go. No one is even discussing the grievances that the Native Americans have as far as that ancestral land goes.
Richard, we're almost out of time here. Anything that you surprised you from this survey?
I think perhaps the most surprising thing was the extent that we allow issues that we don't necessarily see every day to really inform the extent to which we get angry. This idea of whether or not we believe the American dream exists or not, or whether or not our lives turned out the way that we thought we would. Those are sort of serious bedrock issues that inform our worldview. And to the extent that they're present at all, they really fuel or diffuse, in some instances, the degree of anger we have at any moment.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Richard Dorman, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And he's senior editor at Esquire, and we did post a link to the Esquire NBC News poll on our Facebook page. David Love, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well.
Thank
He's a
you.
Journalist and commentator. You're welcome. He writes for The Griot, The Atlanta Black Star, for Huffington Post, among other publications. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.